I'm in Del Mar. I've just finished body surfing with Stan Weir, and I'm interviewing him at his home. Stan, I want to go back a little bit. On the last tape, we talked about you're becoming a teacher. And before you did that, you were involved, you mentioned that you were involved in a in interviewing American labor leaders. Could you tell us more about what that involved and maybe some of the people that you interviewed?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, David Edelstein, who is a professor at Syracuse University, and Malcolm Warner, who was a professor at a British university, were doing a study of British and American unions, comparing them, and how they differed in their competition for top office, top three up, president, general secretary, treasurer, and vice president, and what their constitutions, the role of their constitutions in creating or eliminating competition for office. Now, I was made the major investigator for the American side of this study. It resulted in a book called Comparative Union Democracy by Edelstein and Warner. They were funded by the National Science Foundation as a result of the book, the appearance of Comparative Union Democracy. An attack was made on my contributions to that book by a staffer for the UAW. He attacked my contribution in a review of Comparative Union Democracy for the Labor Studies Journal put out by the Universities and Colleges Labor Education Association, which was the competition to Local 189, formed for that purpose, to create an elite of, a conservative elite of labor educators.
Local 189 was a local?
Was the AFT local for labor educators. And then it disaffiliated to get away from Shanker and has been independent up till, I guess, 1989 or 90 when it affiliated with CWA and became part of official labor again, although it represents no bargaining units. It's a separate local of CWA, just as it was of AFT. But more about that later, that the result of that that attack and the counterattack I made on him, etc. It meant that for a year, I went to Washington, D.C., 1967-68, that academic year. I was working, actually, for the University of Northern Illinois, not Syracuse. He was still at Northern Illinois. And I was a research associate on that faculty, but I wasn't on campus at all. I was in Washington, D.C., interviewing either or both of two of the three top officers of the union with a very long questionnaire.
Why were you in Washington, D.C.?
Because 103 international unions are headquartered in Washington, D.C., because it's convenient for lobbying purposes. It means that they socialize with the power of the country. They wine and dine with people of power at all times, that the trade union heads do. And it's a way of getting far away from the rank and file of your union. So I simply used my credentials to make appointments with them, take the questionnaire with me, ask them as many of the questions as is possible on this long questionnaire. I mean, questionnaire with 93 pages. It was an impossibly long and detailed questionnaire.
How long was the average interview?
Well, if it were done right, the interviews would have had to have been 5 or 6 hours, and I usually never more had more. I seldom had more than two.
2 hours.
2 hours. But sometimes I would be talking to three men in a day, and the totality of it would be. But I didn't get from one; I'd try to get from another.
Did you eliminate any of these questions as time went on?
I was forced to, in order to create a cohesiveness to the whole questionnaire and get to the end of it and so on. I would tell you simply some of the, say, three stories connected with this in three different unions. Try to give you an idea of what the job was like. I made an appointment for an interview with Tony Boyle, for example, who was then president of the United Mine Workers. John L. had died not too many years before that. And just by coincidence, I arrived there in the UMW headquarters on the day that District 50, the non-coal mining segment of the UMW, had disaffiliated, walked out on, split from the parent organization, UMW. Tony Boyle only had John L. Lewis to copy himself after. And he had the press all in there. And while I was in there interviewing him, here came maybe 15 members of the press and some television people and radio people and interviewed him. And he tried to handle it like John L. would have handled it. He had a quotation from Shakespeare. He looked out the window and pointed over at the District 50 building and did that bit, how more sharper than a serpent's tooth, the King Lear speech, where he felt that this daughter, where Lear feels that this daughter doesn't show respect for him. Feeling. And he mumbled the whole quotation, where the speech was obviously written for him. He was reading it off a piece of paper and he couldn't even handle that. He was absolutely an inept person, as most of the hand-picked successors always are. And he was no threat to Lewis.
Right. Yeah.
And Lewis had been using District 50 and exploiting it for years, and really and truly, with a weakling at the top, they found that they were able to say no to Tony Boyle where they could never have said no to John L.
Were these District 50 made up of all other type of miners other than coal miners?
No other miners. They had waitresses, gasoline station attendants, chemical workers, glass workers, and a whole bit in District 50 with a catch-all for everything. Foundry workers, whatever they could get.
Were salt miners, gold miners, silver miners, in the same union as the coal miners?
No.
No.
The United Mine Mill and Smelter had most of the hard rock, the metals, the hard, the metals mining in this country.
That's right.
Yeah. But Tony Boyle would be a couple of years before he masterminded the murder of Yablonsky. All we knew then was his ineptness and his leadership of a bureaucracy that wasn't even thrilled by him at all. They had known him as a stooge before Lewis had stepped in. And he had so little personality that he could hardly answer the questions on the questionnaire. I finally found myself starting to feed him answers so I could get something. Mm-hmm. I would give him multiple choice. Would it be this, this, or this? Mm-hmm. This, this, or this?
What was a typical question on a questionnaire?
Who is it in this union that would run against you in the next election? Who would know enough people? And enough people throughout the various districts. Would it be a leader of a district union? Because the union, UMW, is divided into districts of coal miners, and then the last one, District 50. Or would it be one of the three top officers? Well, he's not about to answer this question straight. It would reveal too much about how he felt about the rest of the bureaucracy. So I just simply had to play it by ear and carry on as best I could and get out of there. And it really was, there was so little substance in that office and all its stooges. As a matter of fact, I found people in the office whom I talked to at some length, three of them, two of them openly critical of him and the way the whole UMW structure was run. Was quite different in Joe Birney's Communication Workers of America, CWA. Joe Birney, B-I-E-R-N-E, was the original president of the CWA from the 1930s. And they had mainly the whole Bell system organized, with some exceptions. In some instances, for example, the Brotherhood of Electrical Workers International Brotherhood of Electrical, IBEW, would have a local of telephone workers. But mainly they had production people and the operators and the directory information people, all of that. But they were beginning to diversify like every other union in the 60s already. They had, a local of Coca-Cola workers in Georgia and were trading around with other unions, various little bargaining units of that sort. If we're going to lose here, you get them. This one over here, you step aside so we can get them. These fringe who were really just dues-based. They were not participants, really, participants in the politics of the union because they weren't in the same industries. They were not for General Electric or any of the Bell systems. Not General Electric. For GTE, General Telephone. Or Bell, AT&T. I first interviewed a vice president. I believe his name was Glenn something or another. He was an aught, as far as I could tell.
Did Birney surround himself with aughts?
I've only met this one other top officer, and he gave me canned answers without any real insights in them for this questionnaire. I then began an interview with Joe Birney himself, who really was the king. And I could see that we were being interrupted constantly as a result of the fact that he was days away from the International Union Convention. I suggested to him that we should finish the interview when the convention was over. He said, that's very good of you to volunteer that. He was very charming about that and gracious. He said, I have to go away after the convention. I will return at such a time and you can interview me. And he gave me a date. But he said, please be my guest at the convention. You'll be sitting in the press box. I arrange all your passes to get in, and your meals will be here, and there'll be a hotel room where there's a typewriter for you if you want to use it while we're there, and so on.
Was the convention in Washington?
Yes. So there was a rebellion. This is the 60s. This is 1968, I guess it is. No longer 67. And it was a nice hotel in the northern part of the district. Wooded in the surroundings. And the rebellion was coming mainly from the Detroit area locals. They had resolutions that were counterposed to the International Union's resolutions in maybe a dozen areas of the convention's subject matter. There were rebels from other areas who, in the main, as far as I could see, were aligned already with the Detroit people, at least for that convention. And it was very difficult for them to get time on the floor and at the mic, anybody who was going to oppose Bernie, because the way the convention was being run. And he had muscle right there. As a matter of fact, I was sitting next to, almost throughout, in the press box, not Pressman, but his main muscle, who had been that for years. And the guy was, at this point, not in good shape any longer. He still acted tough, but all he did was smoke, and he was a guy. As a matter of fact, he keeled over dead a couple of 3 years after I had spent a day talking to him off and on. When the obvious rebellion began to express itself on the floor of the convention indirectly at this point, Bernie made a speech in which he said, "I'll tell you the kind of person I am. If I hadn't been president of this union, become president of this union, I'd be a multimillionaire. Just the way it is." And everybody saw that he was getting nasty to the people below. But this was his way of telling them how good he was and why they ought to appreciate him. And that only distanced him all the more from these delegates. By the end of the second day, I believe it was, in the afternoon session, the rebels were getting the floor and beginning to really go after him and make him look bad. And at one point where he was supposed to answer questions that they had posed for him, the lights went out in the convention hall, and that silenced everybody, that the place was black.
Kind of fitting at a communication workers' convention.
And a spotlight out of nowhere came right on Joe Byrne. He's the only one you can see in the whole convention hall. And he stuck his arms out, straight out, in the sign of a large cross, and said, "Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name," and recited the whole Lord's Prayer. And he set off on a totally different agenda for the rest of the day, and then had guided tours of all the historic places in Washington with buses outside to bus you to your point of your interest. So in effect, he ended the convention with the Lord's Prayer right then. Business never really went ahead from there. Everything was handled bureaucratically.
Wasn't there didn't anybody say, "Hey, what the hell's going on here?"
Oh, they were saying that to themselves, but there was no way they could get to the floor to do anything official to extend the convention. They hadn't made plans for any eventuality of this kind where they would meet in caucus at some other location with a hall that would handle several hundred people, at least several hundred. And for a person to speak to the press and hold press conferences and all that stuff. They were forced to go back home with terrible horror stories about the convention, but not about their ability to affect power and what it was going to do.
Did you meet with Birney after for the interview later?
He never had the time. He never had the time. That was put off. I finally just had to give up on him. And I think I knew people in the convention were covering the convention. And the bodyguard saw who was coming up to me and talking to me about what. And I would be pulling them away half the time. But I think that my mitt got tipped. But that's just my own personal guess, hunch.
The rebellion was centered on, I think you mentioned, Detroit workers?
They were the ones who were the center of the revolt. There was an ongoing attack, particularly on them, and their working conditions in Detroit. And already Detroit was having, you know, a riot. The town was breeding a rebellion. The auto workers were in rebellion. And the black community was in rebellion. And they'd had a riot in which black and white pillaged.
Were black workers present as delegates at any of these?
A few. Mm-hmm. Not many.
Did say Detroit, who were ready to rebel within the Union, did they make alliances with other groups? Were there rebellion spreading, do you think?
I don't know. It was impossible for me to learn that. I was not free in my role in the study to go out and begin doing that kind of spade work in the rebel caucuses.
Did you know anything about Joe Byrne back when he say in the 40s? Had you heard anything?
Well, I'd only heard and read things that he had said or had written. As a matter of fact, I believe he even authored a book or co-authored one, of which I remember reading several chapters, but I'm not certain any longer whether it was written about him or by him, partly by him. And he was had a pretty good rep in the founding days of the CIO, not as a lefty, as I recall, but as simply a good, honest business unionist who represented this new industrial union. But a union that organized absolutely in the most conservative vertical lines of organization and power that was possible to organize by. There was nothing rank and file oriented toward the design. The union was set up so that the rank and file was cut out of the decision making entirely. Everything was, all decisions being made in the center of power in D.C. Third anecdote is about James B. Carey, who had been the president of the United Electrical Workers and then the president of the International Union of Electrical Workers when Carey split from the pro-communist faction, Matlis. What's the other guy's name? The pro-communist leadership of the UE. In 1964, 3 to 4 years prior to my interviewing him, he had been ousted from his position as president of the IUE. He had been challenged by the director of the New Jersey, I believe New Jersey, Maryland, and part of New York district of the IUE. The IUE was set up more like the mine workers in that there were district directors that held district conventions which created dukedoms in the union. And steel was set up this way, exactly this way. The UAW was not. The district directors of the UAW are elected in a two-hour caucus during the international convention, so that really and truly they are almost like an appointees of the president of the UAW. And the spotlight, and there's no such thing as a district convention. It's just a caucus every other year. There had been an election, and the people counting the ballots were wrapping them in bundles of 100 with 99 votes against Kerry on the bottom and the top ballot being for Kerry. And then they'd wrap them and count them as 100 votes for Kerry. And they'd have stacks for the other people in these other stacks, and they would be accurate. They would be all on it. But Kerry won by good margin in this. And when he was caught, it was found that he was soundly defeated. And
how did he get caught? That's incredible, outright fraud.
Yes, yes. Well, there had been poll watchers, and these poll watchers found this blatant dishonesty, and the ballots were impounded. Now, things like this had happened before, and still the top person stayed in office. But in this instance, there was a difference. The Department of Labor, prior to that time, had never once gotten into an election of an international union and taken a stance. They came in on this one with the IUE against James B. Kerry at the insistence of George Meany, president of the AFL-CIO. And Meany had never moved like this against any other international president. But Meany hated James B. Kerry because George Meany had been the secretary of the AFL and Kerry had been the secretary of the CIO and had shown up George Meany, dumbness, backwardness, hundreds of times, made him look bad. And by the way, I dealt with Meany when I was a rep to the British Columbia Seamen's Union, when we were trying to get the Cooks out. And he was a vice president of the AFL at the time, and he really was slow at the switch, and he slow ahead. And so the Department of Labor came in and took the ballots with a federal marshal and put them away in a safe. And when they were counted, Jim Kerry was no longer president of the IUE. When I interviewed him, he was the head of the UN, United Nations group that handles Boy Scouting. He had an office in D.C. with a secretary who had very little to do. Most of the time I was there for two full days, 16 hours, she was doing her nails and things like that, talking to her boyfriend.
How did Kerry get that job?
Well, you make enough contacts living in Washington, D.C., that you're liable to get a piece off of this nature. But it was a pathetic piece off. I mean, he was really isolated. He got, in the 16 hours that I was there, one phone call of a business, of someone who was not his wife or something like that.
So he had plenty of time for you to
interview. Yes. And